This is TalkBack, 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309.
This is News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. KGVO, Missoula's news and weather station.
Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome. It is the Wednesday, March 18th edition of TalkBack, and TalkBack this morning brought to you by Y-West Storage, offering secure, flexible self-storage in Missoula. Call 510, these are all 406 numbers, of course, 510-0590 at Y-West Storage to reserve your unit today. Quality seamless gutters, offering expert gutter installation and repair. Call 728-4002. Get a free quote there. Quality seamless gutters. Bruckner's Truck and Equipment. Heavy duty truck sales, parts and service. Call Bruckner's 541-9097. Busy Bees Cleaning Service. Offering commercial cleaning you can trust. Call 550-3219. Get a free estimate at Busy Bees. Pivots Plus is Montana's leader in irrigation parts, service, and sales. Call Pivots Plus, 683-4418. Gomer's Diesel. Diesel repair parts and service in Missoula. Call Gomer's Diesel at 728-7620. Harrington Surgical Supply. Providing medical and surgical supplies to healthcare professionals all across western Montana. Call Harrington Surgical Supply at 721-8466.
The views and opinions expressed on TalkBack are not those of the staff, management, or advertisers.
Well, good to have you along, everybody. It's the Wednesday edition of TalkBack. Peter Christian here, Mr. Nick Christensen over there. Good morning, Mr. Nick.
Good morning.
He's producing TalkBack, taking care of all the callers this morning. And joining us in the studio, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, the fabulous Bob Seidenschwartz with the Montana World Affairs Council, looking very nattily dressed today, I gotta tell you.
Thank you, Peter, Nick, and good morning. Hopefully everybody's slowing down just a little bit. That fog is dense.
Luckily, it's not foggy in the studio.
No, except for our brain. So let's let's get started. We have a very special guest that's joining us for one precious hour. So, Peter, do you have an introduction here?
No, I don't have one.
Well, then, Jeffrey, I'm going to ask you, because we've had you on the show before, and again, thank you very much for taking some time. I had reached out to you, as you have been a guest on several different occasions, but right now may be one of the most important times in terms of explaining as best we can what is going on and what is the effect that we're seeing. Of course, as we were waiting to come on the show, oil prices are up again today. We see fertilizer having jumped significantly. And so what's happening right now in the Middle East, and specifically with Iran, has massive implications to us on so many different levels. So, Jeffrey, if you could give first just a little background, because I know you're kind of moving from that working world to kind of a quasi-retirement, but I pulled you out of retirement or quasi-retirement to get you on the show here today. So a little bit of background on the work that you've done for many years.
Sure, Bob. I don't use that word, the R word. I refer to myself as self-directed.
Okay. I like it.
Yeah. So just to give you a little bit of background so you have a sense that you know, where I'm coming from on some of this stuff. So, long career in energy, mainly oil and gas. Worked for Texaco for over 20 years and spent the next 20 years working for myself, doing consulting for a whole variety of clients around energy. So, energy companies, financial companies looking at energy, did a lot of writing. Have a blog that's kind of inactive these days, but I wrote a daily blog for years about energy. And the connection between energy and a bunch of other things, including, you know, issues like climate change and all of that. So this is what we're going through right now is something that people have talked about for decades, and, you know, we were always happy it never quite materialized. You know, I mean, there were many previous disruptions in the global oil market. I started my career in the immediate aftermath of the first Iran crisis in the very late 70s, early 80s. And then, of course, you know, you had the Gulf War, first Gulf War, then you had the Iraq War, all kinds of things along the way. But this is the big enchilada. This is the disruption that everybody's been afraid of, but we've never quite seen, where you've got so much of the world's oil, like 20% of the world's oil supply, bottled up behind this little point of maritime transport, the Straits of Hormuz, between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. And essentially, Iran, controlling it is probably not the right word, but they've made enough threats that, you know, the tanker market, the insurance market, people who decide, you know, am I going to try to get my ship through there or not, most of them are hesitant to do that. Some oil, a little bit of oil is moving out, but it's a trickle compared to what moved out before. Alternative ways to get oil out of that area are not sufficient to move the amount of oil that the world needs from the Middle East. So you've got a pipeline that goes across the Arabian Peninsula within Saudi Arabia to the Red Sea. That can only handle an extra, say, 3 to 5 million barrels a day. You've got a small pipeline that goes across the end of the peninsula to the port of Fujairah, and that can only handle maybe 1 million barrels a day. And maybe there's 1 million or 2 million barrels a day of Iranian oil trickling out because they're not shooting at their own tankers, right? But this is a far cry from the 20 million barrels a day that should be flowing out of that area. So this is hugely consequential. And as you alluded to a minute ago, Bob, it's not just oil. I mean, oil is the thing that catches everybody's attention. But one of the largest suppliers of liquefied natural gas in Qatar is also bottled up inside the Persian Gulf right now. Their LNG tankers are not getting out. That has a big impact, particularly in Asia. Lots of fertilizer plants. Why would that be? Well, the typical way to make fertilizer starts with natural gas, and there's a lot of natural gas in the Middle East. So there's a lot of plants that make fertilizer, and now fertilizer shipments are being impacted. That could have a huge impact down the road. So, you know, we're seeing the ripple effects here at the gas pump. Other people are going to see other impacts, you know, where they are, including that, but other things.
Jeff, well, we are up against a break. We're going to come right back. We already have a caller on the line waiting to visit with you, but we want to give you an opportunity to stretch out and make your point before we start taking calls. But 721-1290 is our number, and Jeff and Bob, of course, Jeff will be with us for this hour. We'll be right back after this quick timeout.
With KGRZ Sports, here's your sports update. Brought to you by Campbell Kia of Missoula. New and pre-owned vehicles at a no-pressure buying experience. Located off Expressway and online at CampbellKia.com. Here's Ace Sauerwein.
What a World Baseball Classic final. Venezuela defeats the United States of America 3-2 last night. And I'm pretty sure my ears are still bleeding from the roar of the crowd that crept through the Fox broadcast. Venezuela wins its first ever World Baseball Classic gold medal. The United States has lost back-to-back gold medal games. Garrett Whitlock came in the ninth inning in a tie ball game and gave up a run. It was a go-ahead double from Eugenio Suarez. That came just a few at-bats after Bryce Harper tied things up in the bottom half of the eighth with a booming two-run home run. Outside of that, the U.S. didn't have much going on from the lineup. They scored only two runs, had only three hits, and Venezuela wins the World Baseball Classic.
Dennis Sprague with the Town Square weather. We're still on track for milder and drier conditions to finish the week, although now it looks like some showers may be back for the weekend. Partly sunny Wednesday, mostly sunny Thursday, and sunshine Friday, albeit with a chance of showers creeping into the forecast for Friday afternoon and evening and into Saturday. Really nice warm temperatures, though, to take the snow away. Highs in the low 60s on Wednesday and into the low 70s in a few locations on Friday. Overnight and morning lows will continue in the 40s.
We are back on Talk Back and talking about an extremely timely topic this morning, what's going on with energy supplies, especially in the Middle East. Jeffrey Stiles is joining us, independent policy expert on energy and climate change. And of course, Bob Seidenschwartz here in the studio. Please continue.
We were talking off air, which I think is so important. We get bits of this information in terms of the public realm. What we're having as a discussion is a very deep dive into the implications of this. So I had mentioned to you, it's not just the oil that's a problem. LNG gets shipped out of that region. Europe is a big user of that LNG. in Belgium recently, and I'm going to let you elaborate on this, there's discussions about possibility reconstituting relationships with Russia. You have the competition between the EU and Asia, principally China, of course, but also India. So we've got this perfect storm that's developed. And Jeffrey, would you please elaborate on some of the things you said off air about this?
Well, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, going back to 2022 when Russia attacked Ukraine, that led to most of the European countries, which had been very dependent on natural gas from Russia, to reduce their reliance on Russia. The U.S. has stepped in and filled some of that gap because we're building, rapidly building facilities to export natural gas in its liquid form all over the world. But, you know, particularly we've been backstopping Europe, but they've also been getting gas from the Middle East, from Qatar, which is the big producer there. And Australia is another big producer. So what happens in a situation like this? So we're seeing this with oil. We're seeing this with gas. Everything sort of rearranges. When you have a big disruption like this and you have fewer supplies available, more people then start competing for the supplies that are left, right? So that's part of the process that makes the prices go up. You talk about a price spike. Well, that price spike is made up of people bidding that price up. You know, I need those barrels to fill my refinery in Singapore. No, I need them more to fill my refinery in the UK. And so there's a tug of war that goes on, and somebody wins that tug of war for each tanker, you know, each LNG tanker and that sort of thing. You know, where is LNG used? It's used, for instance, Taiwan shut down nuclear power plants and became more reliant on natural gas for its electricity. Well, if Taiwan can't get LNG because it doesn't produce any natural gas, what happens to the industries that are so critical to the world's economy, making microchips, for instance, if there's no way to power those? You know, so the ripple effects of something like this, you know, we're going to be seeing this, even if this all returned to sort of normal tomorrow, the ripple effects are going to go on for some time.
And we do have a caller on the line that wants to jump in and comment or ask a question. And Steve, go ahead. You're on with the Bob Seidenschwartz and Jeffrey Stiles. Go ahead.
Hey, Jeff. I have a strategy question for you, a U.S. strategy question, and it's probably going to require you to just do some philosophizing, which I'd appreciate. But I've got friends who believe that the Iran war is related to curtailing China's growth as a superpower. My point of view is very different. I think this is all about Israel, given what Marco Rubio admitted to that started the thing, and sort of their ambition to destabilize the Middle East and frankly expand their territorial lands that they have right now to accommodate for their population growth. I'm curious your opinion as an oil guy, gas guy, which is it? And if you had to go sort of with one strategy or the other, I mean, why did we get into this? Is it for China to slow them down, or is it to protect Israel and the Epstein class that we've seen so much of in the last few years? Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, sir.
You know, I think this is a question that's on a lot of people's minds. And you know, clearly, you know, I'm a lot more comfortable talking about, you know, oil and gas and the impacts of that. But, you know, I mean, I do have my own opinions about, you know, the strategic side of this. I think it's unfortunate that we're not hearing a clearer, more unified perspective from our government on what exactly are we trying to do here. But in my mind, you know, I do think about global strategic issues. You know, the nuclear question with Iran, to me, is still number one. You know, Iran, the idea that Iran could ever become a nuclear power, and of course, remember, there was an arrangement with Iran starting during the Obama administration where they would supposedly constrain their nuclear development, but it didn't touch their missile programs. Well, you know, the whole time that they were supposedly constraining their nuclear development, which they really weren't, they were going flat out on building missiles And even if those missiles only had conventional warheads, we're seeing the damage that those missiles can do in the neighborhood. But they were working on building missiles that could reach, you know, well into Europe and potentially even to the U.S. So, you know, what you had here was the worst actor with the greatest capabilities, Iran, that's been behind every problem that we've seen, certainly since the October 7th attack by Hamas in Israel. That's, to me, that's the starting point of this whole process. That's what woke everybody up. And you've seen Israel's response since to work very hard to shut down all of Iran's proxies. So Iran was supporting Hamas. Iran was supporting Hezbollah. Iran has supported the Houthis. So all of these people, you know, they have been doing Iran's bidding and causing disruption in the region. You mentioned the idea that, that Israel's tried to destabilize the area. From my perspective, if I were Israel, my goal is to restabilize the region. And as long as you have Iran armed with, you know, the weapons that it had, and the weapons it was trying to get, the region was never going to be stable. So that's kind of my take on it. Where does China come into this? You know, Iran is part of this connection between Iran and North Korea and Russia and China. There's an alliance between Russia and China. Iran and North Korea are sort of peripheral pieces of that. If we can weaken, you know, one of those legs, then the stool becomes less able to carry the weight. So that's kind of my take on it very quickly. I'd like to get back to the oil and gas side of this, though.
You bet. Sure. We're going to take a break. We have Jeff and Rick both waiting to visit with you, sir. We're going to come right back after this timeout. 721-1290 is our number. Our guest on the phone, Jeffrey Stiles, independent policy expert on energy and climate change. Of course, Bob Seidenschwartz with the Montana World Affairs Council here in the studio. Back after this.
Hello, this
we are back on TalkBack. 721-1290 is our number. It's the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. Bob Seidenschwartz hosting Jeffrey Stiles. We're talking about energy. And let's get a couple of calls in that folks have been waiting for a while. So let's get Jeff on. Jeff, good morning. You're on with Jeffrey Stiles and Bob. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Jeffrey. Great first name, by the way. Really like it. Before I get to my question, I think we went into Iran for a variety of reasons. There is not just one reason. Oil is one. Nukes are one. Damage they've done around the world is one. The way they've taken out our soldiers over 47 years, 1,000 people dead at their hands. There's a whole host of reasons. So try to say, play the whole Israel is behind this and they control the world card, I think is ridiculous. But my question is, eventually, the straits are going to open up. This is going to get resolved one way or the other, and oil and natural gas and fertilizer and all the products that are bottled up there will start flowing again. And when that happens, what will be the effect on the world market for those products? Will we just see kind of a decrease back to where they were? Will we see a dramatic drop and kind of an oscillation until they reach a new price? What do you think is going to happen when the straits open back up?
So Jeff, thank you, Jeff.
Well, you just presented the perfect question here from the standpoint we were talking about this in terms of when things open back up. How does that actually look and happen, and is it the way that it was previously? So, Jeff, please explain to the audience what may this world look like when the straits open up.
Wow, it's a great question. There's so many moving parts here, but you know. I was trading oil in London in 1990-91 when the Gulf War started. And there had been this whole run-up in prices at the end of 1990 during what we called Desert Shield. And prices of oil and its products were getting to record levels. And then we actually started to bomb Iraq. And the fighting started, the invasion started in Kuwait. And amazingly to a lot of people, the reaction of the market was not to go further up. It dropped by like a third within a couple of days, stunned everybody. So that's in our memory, our collective memory, if you will. I don't think that's what we're going to see here. And let me explain why I think that's not likely. So let me give you an analogy. I was trying to think about this last night, and this is not a great analogy, but think about an analogy where you've got a factory in a town, and the town is connected to the outside world by a road that goes over a bridge, right? And the market for the products from the factory is on the other side of that bridge. So now something happens to the bridge, right? And the factory has been running flat out, right? Because the demand for the product is huge. So the factory's been running flat out. So now something happens to the bridge, and you can't drive trucks over the bridge anymore to take the product away. What happens at the factory? Well, the first thing that happens is, you know, they're hopeful that the bridge is going to get fixed. And so they continue to produce, right? So the inventory starts to fill up. Well, at some point, you reach a point where you can't take any more inventory. You can't, the product is perishable. You can't just put it out in the parking lot. So you have to start cutting back the rate that the factory is running at, okay? So, and then some things start happening to the machines when you slow them down, and they're going to require some maintenance before they can really get back up to the rate that they were operating at back before. So meanwhile, there's some delays getting the bridge fixed. And not only that, now you've got some crazy people running around, and they're actually trying to blow up the factory in the meantime, and they've caused some damage to the factory. So in a way, this is what's going on in the Middle East right now, right? You've got oil being produced in countries like Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Kuwait and the UAE, and a lot of these tanks, because the tankers are not showing up to take the oil away, a lot of the tanks are filling up or they've filled up. So what do they have to do? They have to cut back production. That means going to the well and shutting in the well. That's happening all across the Middle East right now. The number that I saw this morning for the amount of oil that's been shut in is 9 million barrels a day. So that's a substantial part of the production. That's, you know, maybe half the production of the region has already been shut in. When the straits open up again and the tankers come back, well, the tankers will come back and they'll start taking the oil that's been accumulated in the tanks, okay? And then people will go out to the fields and they will start trying to bring the oil fields back on. That's not an overnight process. You don't flip a switch. You don't flip a switch on a pump and the pump starts operating everything. It's more detailed than that. You have to be careful not to damage the reservoirs as you're bringing the oil back. So there's going to be delays. So this production that's not happening now, the tanks are full, production is not happening now, it's going to be very hard to make up that production once the straits open up. It's going to take weeks or months, maybe multiple months, right? So during that period, you know, tankers will be leaving again with product, but the places that it's delivering, those tankers are delivering to, those places have low inventories now. So it's going to take a long time, maybe months, many months, for everything to catch up, for inventories to get back to normal levels. But then you think about fertilizer. Now, I know very little about farming, but I do know that if you don't have the fertilizer available at the right time when the crops need it,
right,
you may have missed that whole growing season. Wow. I believe that's right. Right. Yeah. So if there's a massive fertilizer shortage just when people need that fertilizer, it may not do them a lot of good if it's suddenly available 3 months later, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. And with that, sorry to interrupt, but we're up against a break. We're learning so much here in such a short amount of time. We really appreciate your expertise, Jeff. We're going to come right back. We have Rick and Tom and Dave and all sorts of folks who want to visit with you. We're going to come right back and get as many calls in as we can right after this.
Spring weather. Dennis Bragg with the Town Square weather. We're still on track for milder and drier conditions to finish the week, although now it looks like some showers may be back for the weekend. Partly sunny Wednesday, mostly sunny Thursday, and sunshine Friday, albeit with a chance of showers creeping into the forecast for Friday afternoon and evening and into Saturday. Really nice warm temperatures, though, to take the snow away. Highs in the low 60s on Wednesday and into the low 70s in a few locations on Friday. Overnight and morning lows will continue in the 40s.
We are back on Talk Back. We're having a very, very meaty conversation today with Jeffrey Stiles, independent policy expert especially on oil and what's going on in the Middle East. And folks have been waiting on the phone for quite a while, so let's get some calls in. This is Rick. Rick, go ahead.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is I think our administration is playing the long game where nobody else has over the last 50 years. Everybody's played the short game with Iran, and it just keeps on escalating to the point of where this was eventually going to happen. But my real question is West Coast energy. Refineries are shutting down in California at an alarming rate. There's no refinery capability in Oregon, and the refineries that are in Washington are pumping oil into Oregon. And California being the breadbasket, specifically of the Pacific Northwest, fruits and vegetables, at some point, this is going to affect the farming community, especially for California. They have no pipeline coming from the east going to California. They'll have to get all their oil as we speak by tankers. When do you think the short-sightedness of the bureaucrats on the West Coast is going to change? Because this is going to affect the nation. I don't care what they pay for gas in California, Oregon, and Washington, but it's going to affect the agricultural industries when more refineries shut down in California due to bureaucratic boondoggles.
All right.
So could you answer that?
Thanks for the call.
Well, so Rick, I mean, this is a question that is near and dear to my heart. I grew up in California. I consider myself sort of a California exile or California emigrant, if you will. I spent the first 10 years of my career in the oil and gas business in California. I've been watching this for a long time, and I've been asking this question for a long time. I mean, when are people going to wake up in California? I looked at the prices this morning. A gallon of gasoline in Los Angeles, somewhere between $5.75 and $6 a gallon. And the national average today is about $3.80. And that's about what we're paying in my community here in Northern Virginia. But then you look at diesel. Mm-hmm. And diesel is sort of the thing that people have somewhat ignored in all this. But, you know, diesel is the thing that drives the economy.
That's right.
Yeah, we fill up our cars with gas, but it's diesel that gets the food moved around. It's diesel that gets the fertilizer delivered to
it hauls the freight.
Field.
Yeah,
you know, all of these things run on diesel. A gallon of diesel in Los Angeles is $7 today. National average is about $5, and this is already as high as it's been, even in the immediate aftermath of the Russian attack on Ukraine and all of that. So, you know, that we're going to be seeing those kind of impacts for a long time. Of all the parts of the U.S., the West Coast right now is the most vulnerable to what's happening out there because of the policies in California. When I traded oil in California, California produced 1 million barrels a day of crude oil. The current production is about a third of that. When I traded oil on the West Coast, Alaska was producing 2 million barrels a day. It's currently producing 400,000 barrels a day. So there's not nearly enough oil produced in California and Alaska to supply the refineries, even the refineries that are left. And a lot of refineries have shut down, and more will shut down. So you have this problem that, you know, unlike the Gulf Coast, so the East Coast is a different issue. Most of the East Coast is supplied by pipeline from the Gulf Coast, or by refineries on the East Coast, or imports from places like Canada or the UK, right, for products. But something like 60% of the oil that's refined in California is now imported. Not a lot of that has come from the Persian Gulf, but some of it has. And as the markets rebalance around the world, California refineries, the ones that are left, and the ones in Washington State, they're going to be out there competing for those barrels with people in Singapore, people in South America, with people anywhere, right? And they're also reliant on imports for gasoline because the refineries that are left can't produce enough gasoline. all of that's going to have impact on every aspect of the economy of the West Coast states and of the breadbasket of California. I went to my undergraduate degree is from University of California, Davis, in the heart of the agricultural heartland of California. So I've seen that stuff firsthand. And, you know, it's going to be very, very hard on the farmers. And it's going to start being hard on consumers when, you know, things that we're used to in the grocery store either are not available or they become more expensive. And look, I don't want to paint this as a worst-case scenario and gloom and doom, but even with the steps that are being taken, you know, releases from the SPR, we could talk a long time about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and the kind of state that it's in right now. The International Energy Agency is doing comparable things in Europe and Japan. But the steps that are being taken don't come close to filling the gap that's being left by the oil that's not coming out of the Middle East right now.
And with that, we're up against a break. We're going to come right back. We have all sorts of folks waiting on the line to talk. Tom and Dave are both waiting to visit with you. And we only have about 18 minutes left in our time with Jeff Stiles. Yeah. And we're learning a lot, and a lot of folks are probably feeling a little quivery right now, and probably rightfully so. So we're going to come right back after this timeout.
We all have someone we love, like the favorite lyric in our favorite song. You can't imagine life without them. So tell them today, I love you. Get screened. It could help save their life. Visit cancer.org/get screened to learn more.
We're back on Talk Back and Montana World Affairs Council. Bob Seidenschwartz here in the studio. Jeff Stiles joining us on the phone right now. And, all of us are kind of quivering in our boots right now, Bob.
We have callers we're going to get to. I'm going to ask the callers, please get to your question.
Yeah.
We only have like 15, 16 minutes at this point. So
right.
If you would.
Yes. All right. Let's get to Tom. Tom, quickly, what's your question for Jeff?
Yeah, good morning. Not to get too political here, but... the very first day of the Biden administration, he shut down the Keystone Pipeline. I just wondered where we'd be if we weren't constantly doing all this stuff to restrict energy production. Thank you, sir.
All right, your thoughts, Jeff?
Well, look, there over the years, there's been a lot of self-inflicted wounds. That's a phrase that Bob used a moment ago off air. But yes, Keystone should have been built. And it wasn't. We've worked around that. But one of the things that's happened, and it's a consequence of us not going ahead with Keystone and some of the friction between the U.S. and Canada over the last year or two, Canada decided that maybe it wasn't in their best interest to have almost 100% of their energy output captive to the U.S. market. So they finally, after years of debate, they expanded their pipeline going west.
The Trans-Canada.
So they are actually able to export a lot more crude oil from the West Coast to markets in Asia. So some crude that would have previously gone to the U.S. is now going to Asia. Again, it's a self-inflicted wound, and it shouldn't have happened that way. But let's flip to the positive side of this for a moment, because, you know, I try to be an upbeat person, and, you know, this is all kind of sounding like gloom and doom. The thing that I'd like to come back to is that some things that were done right is, you know, the shale revolution in this country has put us in a completely different position than we were in during previous energy shocks, right? When the first oil crisis happened in the 1970s. U.S. oil production had peaked, and we were becoming more and more dependent on imported oil. By the time the Iranian crisis happened, we were significant importers of oil from the Middle East and other places. By the time the Gulf War happened, we were importing a lot of oil, and U.S. production had been on a steady downward trend for a long time. Shale turned that around. And with shale production, both on oil and on gas, it's turned the U.S. into a net exporter of energy. I have to be careful here because we still import crude oil. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We import crude oil because U.S. refineries can't run 100% of the oil that the U.S. produces. And the U.S. doesn't produce quite enough oil to fill up all the refineries anyway. But so there's a balance. We produce about 13 million barrels a day. We import 5 or 6 million barrels a day. The refineries run about 18 or 19 million barrels a day. And then 2 or 3 million barrels a day of crude get exported and product. We're exporting a lot of product. So U.S. refineries have found profitable markets outside the U.S., and it's a way that they've been able to stay in business in states other than California, which has just basically put the lid on everything. So, you know, the good side of this thing is the U.S. is going to be much less affected. We're going to see gas prices go up. We're seeing diesel prices go up. The price impacts happen because we're in a global market. These products are all traded in a global market. But I don't foresee, and I could be wrong, but I don't foresee, you know, gas lines and actual shortages of product unless this were to go on for a very long time.
All right.
Those things are already happening in other countries.
Let's try to get another caller in before we take our break. Dave has been waiting quite a while. Dave, what's your question for Jeff? Go ahead, please.
Yes, do you think this bombing will fix Iran, or is this just mowing the lawn?
Wow.
When you don't have fertilizer to make the lawn have to get mowed more than a couple of times, maybe you get your answer, Dave.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's total. It doesn't solve anything. All the bombing doesn't fix what's happening. That's not, you know, it's like the carpenter with a hammer. He thinks a hammer will fix every problem. Well, bombing doesn't always fix every problem.
Look, I think that the problem that we've got is, you know, the U.S. has been burned by, you know, our involvement in wars that went on way longer than we thought that they should.
Thanks,
right?
Dave.
The Iraq War, which was actually the war part of it was won in about 3 or 4 months, right? And then we had the whole occupation, and a lot of that didn't go well. So we're very reticent to go in with boots on the ground. What can we do from the air? I guarantee you that with what's happening to Iran right now, it's going to be, even if we walked away tomorrow and said, you know, victory complete, it would take them years to get back to where they were. Now, if you don't change the regime, if the same kind of guys are in charge, you know, they're going to still want to find ways to cause trouble in the area, but they're going to have a harder time to do it for a long time. So is it just mowing the lawn? I think it's mowing the lawn and maybe putting some Roundup on the lawn as well. But eventually, you know, if we walked away now, 5 years from now, we could be back in the same position. But I don't think that's how this ends.
All right, with that, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back. George is waiting to visit with you, sir. And Jeffrey, thank you so much for taking calls from our listeners and sharing all your expertise with us. All we have is an hour, so we're going to make the best of the time we have left after this quick timeout.
Hello, this is
Dennis Bragg with the Town Square Weather. We're still on track for milder and drier conditions to finish the week, although now it looks like some showers may be back for the weekend. Partly sunny Wednesday, mostly sunny Thursday, and sunshine Friday, albeit with a chance of showers creeping into the forecast for Friday afternoon and evening and into Saturday. Really nice warm temperatures, though, to take the snow away. Highs in the low 60s on Wednesday and into the low 70s in a few locations on Friday. Overnight and morning lows will continue in the 40s.
Hey, we are back on Talk Back, the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. Joining us on the phone, Jeff Stiles. And let's get George's question. He's been waiting quite a while. George, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks to you guys. Okay, I just want to back up a little bit. You know, Trump he's not normal. And we need to all realize that. This man has had millions in his pocket from his daddy from years ago. You know, and his mentality is that he can buy his way out of anything. And that's the way he's run all his businesses and the casinos he's gone broke with. You know, he is not normal. He didn't go to the basic class that you and I and most normal people go to of give and take, empathy, working for a solution. His idea is money and self-gratification. I think it was very evident when he said the other day, when he was asking other countries to help with the Strait of Hormuz, he said, you know, these other countries need to help. And then he goes, but we don't really need them. We don't need anybody.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that's what he said. We don't need anybody. And that's his mentality. And so what I think we really need is for people that voted for him. And I understand. I have lots of Trump friends. I understand. I understand the choice. But we need those folks to realize, okay, a mistake has been made. This guy out of control. He just kicked the hornet's nest. And now we've got hornets flying all over the world and problems. We need to backtrack, realize our mistakes. You know, when you're digging a hole and you're in a problem, the first thing is you got to stop digging. We need to get that man out of there. And that's it's the sooner that some Republicans and some people that voted, and I understand why people would vote for him
right
back then.
Thanks.
But we need to have folks realize.
Thanks, okay. Thanks for the call. Bob, go ahead.
So, first, thank you for your comments. And, Jeff, we only have a couple of minutes. What do you want to tell?
We have 4 minutes.
All right, 4 minutes. What would you be telling the American consumers right now? Because people are feeling the effects of what's happening. I think what you've described is in preparation for even more cost increases across a number of different economic components of the economy. So, given what you've shared with us right now, what would you say to the people listening from a consumer standpoint?
So I think the reality is prices are going to be going up for a while, but we also have a lot more tricks in our bag than we did during previous oil crises, right? Zoom and work from home, those were not an option in 1979, okay, or in 1991. There's a lot of ways that we can reduce demand, and that's ultimately what this is going to come down to, is demand is going to go down, partly because prices are really high,
mm-hmm.
but partly because we have other things that we can do. We're already seeing other countries say, okay, we're back to work from home for a while. We know how to do that. There's other things that we know how to do. Inflation is probably going to go up. But inflation, you know, we've most of the inflation that had been created and the response to COVID during the previous administration, most of that inflation has been driven out of the market. The little bit of it that's left, this is going to be a new pulse of inflation, but hopefully temporary. So, you know, I think buckle up, but at the same time, you know, don't despair, because, you know, I think we're in better shape than a lot of other countries are, and I think we'll get through this better than our parents and grandparents would have gotten through the same thing.
So, Jeff, with a few closing comments.
We have about three minutes. Yeah.
So from what you're saying, this is where, you know, every household right now has to kind of look at what they're doing, where they spend their money, what their cost is. And to your point, you've got the ability to make decisions, which many people in parts of the world don't have that option. So how do you kind of close the circle here in the minute and 40 seconds and counting we have left?
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure I've got a lot of personal advice in my pocket for what people, because look, everybody's in a different situation, right? You know, there are a lot of people in this country. When the price of gas goes from $3 a gallon to $4 a gallon, they're going to have to really change what they do. And maybe even the job that they have is not going to look as attractive because they have to drive an hour to get to it, right? You know, you have other people that'll say, well, okay, yeah, the gas is expensive, but that's only a small percent of my monthly budget. So, you know, I'll do some things differently. And, you know, that's the other side of this is, in terms of the economy as a whole, this is the other benefit of shale. Yes, prices are going up at the pump, but where is that money going? That money is not going to producers in the Middle East the way it did in previous oil crises, right? That money is staying in the U.S. economy mainly. It's going to people that are producing oil in the U.S., and those people are spending that money in the U.S. You know, they may hire more people to produce more oil. You know, the people who are working in the field and the oil rigs and the pipelines and all that, they may have more money to spend in their communities. You know, so the money's not leaving the U.S. this time in the same way that it did in the past. That's going to be cold comfort for people who are really struggling. But for a lot of the rest of us, you know, it means that things are going to be different for a while. But we can envision that they could potentially get back to something like they had been.
Well, Jeff, well, we have about less than a minute left. So if you wouldn't mind giving us some contact information about how we can find out more about your work, please.
as Bob had said at the beginning of the call, I mean, I'm really kind of winding things down. I have a dormant blog at energyoutlook.blogspot.com. I don't think I've added to that in the last 5 years. So if you can follow me on Twitter, my handle is at GSW Strategy. So I try to post on Twitter on a fairly regular basis, but, you know, it's 280 characters at a time.
Yeah,
so,
it has been a delight talking with you. I want to say thank you for sharing your expertise with us. You have a great day, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you. You
Thanks,
too.
Jeff.
Thank you, sir. We're going to come right back after the top of the hour, ladies and gentlemen, and we are shifting gears, talking to Peter Stark, adventure historian, is going to be in the studio with us for this next hour. So please stay with us on Talk.
This is TalkBack, 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309.
This is News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. KGVO, Missoula's news and weather station.
Hey, good morning once again, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of TalkBack. TalkBack this morning brought to you by Harrington Surgical Supply, providing medical and surgical supplies to healthcare professionals all across western Montana. Call Harrington. Their number is 721-8468. Of course, these are 406 numbers. Gomer's Diesel offers diesel repair parts and service in Missoula. Call Gomer's Diesel at 728-7620. Pivots Plus is Montana's leader in irrigation parts, service, and sales. Call Pivots Plus, 683-4418. Busy Bees Cleaning Service, commercial cleaning you can trust. Call 550-3219. Get a free estimate at Busy Bees. Bruckner's Truck and Equipment, heavy-duty truck sales, parts, and service. Call 541-9097. Quality Seamless Gutters of Montana. Expert gutter installation, be good on a day like this, and repair, call Quality Seamless Gutters 728-4002 and get a free quote. And by Y-West Storage, secure flexible self-storage in Missoula. Call Y-West Storage 510-0590 to reserve your unit today.
The views and opinions expressed on TalkBack are not those of the staff, management, or advertisers.
Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you along. And we are definitely shifting gears, talking from the economy. Well, I guess another adventure. I guess it would be. Well, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, you know, when I...
Peter Stark is with us, I
should
say.
We've got Peter here, who's been a frequent guest. When I told Peter about who we were going to have on the first hour, what we really thought about is kind of synthesizing that with what this discussion would be, maybe on a little bit more of a broader scale in terms of how empires fall, but very specific to certain things that we can learn from the past history that we actually see unfolding right now. So this is going to be, we're going to put this out there as what the agenda is, and we're going to identify that. And then, of course, Peter, your favorite turn, letter buck.
And it all goes down to, these are all things we've seen before, right? So
for thousands of years,
yes, right, exactly.
It turns out.
So please, we thought we'd Peter Stark, ladies and gentlemen.
So Peter, let's get going. You had said, how do empires fall? And there's several different ways that that happens over a period of time. You just said that, of course, this is something that's not new. It's been going on for thousands of years. So why should we expect it to be different going forward will be the question we'll try to answer at the end of our time here.
And we're also looking at about three different points,
yes,
of what we think are causes for the fall of empires over history.
Right. So would you please also mention those right now, too?
So... one is overextension, mm-hmm, trying to go too far.
Over-leveraged, as we say in the markets.
Over-leveraged, and I have a direct experience with that.
Could that be also equated with greed?
Totally.
Never missing.
And lust for power.
Yeah, don't forget avarice and greed and all that good stuff. Yeah.
And the reason I won't delve into this just to mention in passing, but I'm really aware of that because the book that I've just finished coming out April 14th. Oh, by the way, I'm giving a reading at Missoula Public Library.
Great.
April 13th, between 6 and 7, for my Lost Cities of El Norte, Coronado's Quest, The Unconquered West.
Talk about greed
and the birth of American Indian resistance. And so I'm really aware of, you know, having been researching that book for 2.5 or 3 years and writing it, Spain, you know, discovered, so to speak, the New World and all these treasures and gold and blah blah blah, and then within about 100 years, it overextended itself, and it couldn't protect, you know, two continents, or certainly one, you know, Central America, Mexico, a lot of South America. So that was a classic example of overextension, and then they were struggling. I think they ended up, you know, they had to go to the Brussels bankers and borrow money. But so that's what point one. And then point two is we were talking about geography and, and really every society is profoundly influenced by geography. And in that, we will include meteorology and, you know, patterns of rainfall have done a lot to wipe out empires. And some very visible ones in Central America and Mexico, that area, there were a number of empires got wiped out by drought. Same, I think, in the Mediterranean, one of the big ones was, I think I don't know much about this. There have been books written about this, though, that the Romans were deforested a lot of the Mediterranean basin. And that it started changing rainfall patterns. And the third, technological changes, which were, that's a really interesting one that Bob, we were kind of going over this yesterday, and Bob mentioned the use of AI, you know, which is a very current thing, of course, and nobody knows quite where it's going to go. Right. And does it become this powerful military tool, weapon? Does it not live up to its reputation? Does it take over the world? I mean, who
all
knows?
All depends on who's programming.
Right.
Seriously.
And so Bob was talking about technological changes as a disruptive moment in history. And the one I thought, because I've been studying empires for a long time, starting in college, I took a great course called The Rise and Fall. Yeah, it's called The Rise and Fall of Civilizations. And that was really interesting. So I've kept up with that. I'm always looking for rising and falling empires.
I'm glad somebody's looking after that. So you're keeping up with that. Go ahead.
But the one that really comes to mind, about technological changes, it's such a vivid one. So the horse had been domesticated for some thousands of years. And, you know, people like in Asia were riding the horse and Europe and whatnot. And typically in all of those places, especially in Asia, there were, you know, horse cultures. And they would have the stirrup was like a strap of cloth or leather. And then in about 1200 AD, somewhere around there, maybe a little earlier, the Mongols, I mean, these are people of the steppe. They're horse breeders and herders.
That's their culture.
Yeah. Complete. These are the original cowboys for sure, and they invented a stirrup that had a flat bottom made of metal and sometimes wood, and that allowed them to be really accurate archers from their horses, and you know, throw spears and, you know, chase people around a lot with a lot more agility than they could. And they swept all the way from Japan almost to Western Europe. They got as far as at least way into Eastern Europe. So that's 5,000 miles. They conquered in a few decades with their horses and their stirrup.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, that's just the first segment of our time together with Peter Stark. So so we'd love to have some calls if you have questions or comments. I know Peter loves to take calls from our listeners, and 721-1290 is our number, 1-800-568-5309. Coming back with part two of the Montana World Affairs Council right after this.
Dennis Bragg with the Town Square weather. We're still on track for milder and drier conditions to finish the week, although now it looks like some showers may be back for the weekend. Partly sunny Wednesday, mostly sunny Thursday, and sunshine Friday, albeit with a chance of showers creeping into the forecast for Friday afternoon and evening and into Saturday. Really nice warm temperatures, though, to take the snow away. Highs in the low 60s on Wednesday and into the low 70s in a few locations on Friday. Overnight and morning lows will continue in the 40s.
Hey, we are back. This is Talkback, 721-12. 1290 is the number. I'm Peter Christian. The questions are taking your phone calls this morning. Producing Talkback, as he always does. Joining us here in studio this morning, we have Bob Seidenschwartz with the Montana World Affairs Council and his special guest, a familiar and very welcome addition to Talkback, is Peter Stark.
Adventure historian. At PeterStarkAuthor.com.
PeterStarkAuthor.com. Thank you. I'm going to write that down right here.
Peter, you got a little story about that because you've been on the show a couple of times. Somebody said to you,
it was an office manager at a doctor's office, and whom I've known for years, and she said the other day, well, I didn't know you were a writer.
Oh my gosh.
And she said, well, I was.
I'm a plumber in my spare time.
Yeah. But I was listening to Bob Seidenschwartz's show, and I said, oh, I know that guy.
So the tentacles go very far here, Peter. Right.
That's right.
The reason I mention that is because I do have this talk on April 13th at the Public Library, and the details will be on my website at PeterStarkAuthor.com. So I'm just plugging I want to fill up the fourth floor of the library.
Sounds good.
Well, a well-deserved topic, so let's continue to help kind of promote this. So we had a guest on previously talking about what's happening right now in the energy world. And you always hear terms like resiliency, resource availability, and then, of course, infrastructure, all the things that go along with civilization since the beginning of time. So we start with talking about the rise and fall of empires. We lay out foundationally certain key points. And you're going to talk about, specifically now, the Spanish Empire.
It was the Spanish Empire, and as I said, my book, Lost Cities of El Norte, really tracks this very closely. And Spain was actually a fairly weak power in the 1300s into the 1400s. And it was actually Portugal was the real power, and it was a seafaring power. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was there was a Portuguese empire, so to speak. And they were sending ships all the way around Africa to the Far East, to India, to build a spice trade. And they became extremely wealthy. Then Spain got into the act. And, Christopher Columbus said, okay, hey, how about we go? I got an idea, let's go west. And he ran into the Americas, completely unexpected. And I think to the day he died, he still thought he was in India.
I'm sure.
And so the big point being, Spain, in terms of Europeans, in terms of that era, discovered the New World. And, of course, there are thousands of Indian tribes there who have been there for a long time and very sophisticated urban areas.
At what point did somebody figure out that from the east coast of what is now the United States all the way to where they thought they were going to China, that there's a whole Pacific Ocean there in between? So
that took a while to work.
I was going to say.
Really, that people kept talking about the island of California that they thought was part of Greater India or Greater China. And that concept even lasted up until like the 1700s on the East Coast. Because, the Spaniards, they didn't like to hand out their map, their discoveries.
We didn't have satellites at the time.
And we didn't have satellites, yeah. And so in Virginia, they're saying, well, we own everything from, what's Jamestown all the way to the island of California. And it's like, oh, where's that?
You want to pay taxes on all that?
Yeah, that's right.
I tell you what, we have a caller who's waiting, and we'd like to get our callers on as quickly as we can. It's Rick. Rick, you're on with Peter Stark and Bob Seidenschwartz. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter, you hit the nail right on the head about the stirrups. They were like a technology that was, we wouldn't call advanced, but for its time. And before that, the four-wheeled chariot turned into a two-wheeled chariot.
Exactly.
Developed by the Mesopotamians. But my question is coming back to America. There's always been this conspiracy theory, and this might be in your wheelhouse, of the Egyptian Southwest connection, specifically in the Grand Canyon. And I believe it's a total fantasy, but can you tell me where that started? I know it started in the late 1800s by an explorer that was published in a newspaper in Arizona. But now there's conspiracy theories that the government's protecting sites in the Grand Canyon that you can't go into because there's ancient Egyptian.
I see where you're going. Yeah, interesting point. I think we talked about some of this last time. Some other theories. With it's Rick, right? Yeah. Thanks for that good question.
Thanks, Rick.
The short answer is no. And that, I mean, there's no evidence that I've heard of. There's no evidence at this point that there are any Egyptian ruins in the Grand Canyon. But I think what's interesting is when you say this idea started in the 1800s, the late 1800s, because that was the era when you know, like, educated archaeologists first started exploring the Southwest and finding these, you know, kind of very large structures and huge stone places of worship. And in the Chaco Canyon, Chaco civilization, there are roads radiating out for dozens of miles from a central point, absolutely straight roads. And so, you know, these were out in the desert, you know, like, where did this come from? Well, it came from people building it. They didn't have to come from Egypt. They came from people who lived there and over centuries, and who developed these more urban civilizations where they were able to typically, you know, the classic anthropological definition of an, you know, urban civilization is when you're able to grow enough food, you know, that you have a wealthy enough area to grow food, so you can supply your society with enough food that not everybody has to grow their own food. And so then what happens is these other classes develop. So typically a religious class, kind of an artistic class, a ruling class, and that happened in the Southwest.
Okay, with that, we're going to come right back. Phone lines are open at 721-1290. Peter Stark, adventure historian, and Peter Stark, peterstark.author.com?
peterstarkauthor.com.
All right, just want to make sure.
All one word.
Got it. peterstarkauthor.com. We're going to come right back and hopefully get your phone calls, and we'll come back right after this.
Sorry.
Montana State News Network.
I'm Dennis Bragg. Some big transportation news out of Missoula, where the Metropolitan Planning Agency is giving its approval to the Reserve Street Safety Plan, completing a multi-year effort to try to make the busiest corridor in the state safer. Transportation planner Aaron Wilson says the four-tier plan would start with more steps to control the flow of traffic and pedestrians to prevent conflicts and sometimes deadly crashes based on a thorough analysis.
What does the data tell us? What's happening out there? And then what are people experiencing? And what does that perspective tell us about how we might approach safety?
In addition to speed control, intersections like Reserve and Mullen could see improvements depending on future funding. The battle over a long dock on Flathead Lake takes another turn, with Flathead Beacon reporting a judge is ordering construction stopped on the 159-foot dock in Lakeside. Citizens for a Better Flathead convinced the judge the project may violate the state's lakeshore rules. The county had approved the dock last year. A 23-year-old man now facing charges after prosecutors say he fired 10 shots during a confrontation in a Missoula alley earlier this month. Tyler Sisler Mack arrested after an investigation by Missoula police and the FBI. They say he's been involved in past gang activity. Great Falls police sorting through details of a weekend shooting where a family disturbance turned into something much more dangerous. Sunday night, officers called to the 600 block of 17th Avenue South when shots rang out. Fortunately, no one was hurt. Petition drives are underway to find support for a ballot measure, the latest in the development and the ongoing debate over nonpartisan judges.
If you've been out running errands lately, you've probably seen people with clipboards in parking lots asking for signatures. It's about a petition to keep Montana judicial elections nonpartisan, the way they've been for nearly a century. Supporters say keeping party labels off the ballot helps protect the courts from political influence and outside money. Others argue party labels could give voters more information about candidates. Right now, it all comes down to gathering enough signatures to get the issue on a future ballot. Tracy Taylor, Montana State News Network.
Elena had another asthma attack. She's really sad to miss school again.
Asthma can be triggered by allergens from common pests.
I just can't shake this fever.
Mosquito bites can cause West Nile and Zika virus infections.
Sorry, boss. I'm going to be out of work for a while.
The CDC estimates that more than 300,000 Lyme disease cases spread by ticks occur in the U.S. each year. Don't let pests force you to take a sick day. Learn how to protect your family at pestworld.org. A public service message from the National Pest Management Association and the CDC.
Enough already.
We can do more.
Enough already.
we can find a cure.
Enough already.
We can do better for our kids.
Enough already. We are relying on you.
We can come together to support Children's Cancer Research Fund, a national nonprofit dedicated to ending childhood cancer that is on the front line of breakthroughs. Because
it's enough already.
Go to childrenscancer.org today.
Okay, we're back. This is Talk Back, and our guest here in the studio is Peter Stark, adventure historian, and we have callers who are waiting very patiently during the break. Steve is up first. Steve, good morning. You're on with Peter Stark. Go ahead.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, Pete. How are you?
Good.
Hey, sounds like you're, I apologize, I missed the beginning of the show. You're from, or you live in this area, is that right?
Yeah, I've been here 45 years, in Missoula.
Okay. All right, perfect. So, given your discussion around some of the first peoples, as I prefer to call them, I think we're all native at this point. You'd mentioned Chaco, which I've been to before, but actually, more interestingly, is the inhabitation of this area to me, which I'd appreciate it if you could briefly talk to Peter and the audience about Cooper's Ferry. I'm hoping you're familiar with Cooper's Ferry. It's the second oldest human-inhabited site that we've so far identified in North America, somewhere between 16 and 18,000 years old based on radiocarbon data. The reason I ask you to talk about it a little bit is because folks on this show called in have said I was incorrect at inhabitants in the Bitterroot and Missoula Valleys dating back well over 600 generations or more based on science I've seen, somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 years. That folks have told me on this show that I'm wrong about that, given that Cooper's Ferry is a short three-hour drive from us. Wait,
tell me where Cooper's Ferry is, Steve. I know a number of these early sites, but Cooper's Ferry, I'm sure I've heard of it. It's in Idaho?
Yeah, you go down to Willow, take a right at the hayloft on Highway 12, and go exactly 3 hours due south-southwest on Highway 12 through the Locksaw down onto the Clearwater, and you will eventually get to Cooper's Ferry. It's the behind White Sands, which is close to Chaco. It's the second confirmed human-inhabited site in North America.
Okay, I'll have to learn more about that. You're right.
You probably can't answer the second, the other piece, but and that's fine, no problem at all. I just wanted to point out to Peter in particular that we've had Salish Kootenai, Nez Perce, all kinds of first peoples here for a long time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're totally right. Yeah. I follow this in a general way. And
thanks, Steve.
The age of first, you know, humans' presence recorded in the Americas keeps getting rolled back. And so, and as you mentioned, White Sands, I think I brought this up the other day, they found human footprints that are around 20,000 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah, thanks for the call. I love that stuff. We're gonna keep going with we're heading into empires rising.
Let's get this one call off before we do that. So, Jeff, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yeah, just real briefly on the previous call, up here at the top of Folsom Hill, there's an overlook looking up into Glacier, and there talks a story about Beaver and how he broke the dam and all the water went rushing out, which is, I think, a reference to Glacier Lake Missoula and indigenous folks trying to figure out what all that really meant. So it's been here for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I know. I just think that's cool that it's becoming increasingly evident that there were humans in this region while the Ice Age was plenty active, and Glacier Lake Missoula would have been coming and going. And so just what you're talking about, that's a great story about the beaver, you know, chewing away the dam and opening up the sluice gates. But go ahead with your next question or comment.
Well, yeah, I think the Salish here came out of the coastal Salish, who were seafaring folks. And I think they saw Glacier Lake Missoula as another place to take their boats. And when the lake disappeared, I don't know what they did, but it must have really been something to watch islands turn into mountains.
yes.
which kind of goes into my my question, which is, you know, ancient civilizations came and went a lot of times because of decades-long changes in climate, you know, droughts that happen and different things. We're different. We have technologies that they didn't have. And so have you done any research or any has anybody done any prognostications on what technology will do in the event that things like, you know, water goes away, we can desalinate water, those sorts of things?
So, yeah, no, that's a really good point. And that, I think we should address that. We're going to talk about, we're going to move towards environmental stresses in our discussion of the rise and fall of civilizations. And but that's a great point, and that there's so much more technology available to us today, but there are also, you know, unforeseen events that happen, you know, that whether it's you know, plague or it's you know, things we humans just don't anticipate, and there's no technology to deal with it. So, okay, so we're up against the
break. We're going to come right back. And we have Andy waiting on the phone. When we come back, 721-1290 is our number, 1-800-568-5309. Bob Seidenschwartz and his guest, Peter Stark, adventure historian, continues after this. Hey, we're back on Talk Back. 721-1290 is our number. I'm Peter Christian. Take questions and taking your phone calls this morning. Adventure historian Peter Stark here in the studio along with Bob Seidenschwartz. And let's get Andy's call in. He's been waiting through the break. So, Andy, go ahead.
Hi, Andy.
Good morning. Thanks for this interesting conversation. I was just chuckling to myself thinking how ridiculous this would all sound to our governor. Our governor apparently only believes the earth is only 6,000 years old. He supports a creationist museum. And isn't it ridiculous that we have a governor who doesn't believe any of this, that he believes that earth is just 6,000 years old while we've got footprints that are 20,000 years old on this continent? I just wanted to point out how ridiculous that all is.
All right, Andy, thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks. I mean, there are a lot of spiritual beliefs about different ages of the earth and when people are here and when people are on this continent. And, you know, that's all fine with me. It's, you know, and then we can look at what the actual, you know, science is. And that's what I go with. And so that's what I'm sticking with.
Okay, let's move on.
We started the conversation with identifying some key issues that we have found parallels between thousands of years ago, even up to the present. And that connects wonderfully to the conversation we had in the hour prior to you arriving. So let's go back to Spain. Over-leveraged. They were over-leveraged, which is not unknown to us now. So talk about Spain a little bit and its over-leveraged situation, and then what are those consequences that we can draw parallels with today?
So, you know, basically Spain discovers, so to speak, the New World, and it claims a lot of it, and it literally manages to militarily conquer a good chunk of it. You know, the Inca Empire, the Aztec Empire, a lot of empires in Central America. And then... It started, you know, it got a lot of treasure, literally, I mean, gold, you know, and other precious things from those conquests. But then it kept pushing, looking for more. And I mean, one of the guy I'm writing about, Coronado, he pushed from Mexico City up all the way to Kansas looking for gold. You know, it takes some money to mount expeditions like that. And Spain, then, you know, in the places where it did conquer, you know, all through Mexico and Central America and big chunks of South America, Spain had to develop a military presence there, and Spain had to pay for that military presence. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to say, well, we conquer this territory. It's another thing to hang on to it, and it gets really expensive to hang on to it. So Spain essentially ran out of money and had to go to bankers in Northern Europe to borrow money to help pay for their armies.
So somewhere in the monarchy is some guy wearing his glasses, with his little, at that time, calculator in his pocket. Yeah. And he says
the royal accountant.
Yeah, yeah. Mini abacus.
Yeah, he says to the queen, madam, you are overdrawn. And we have a problem here in terms of receipts in and money out. So then they go to who?
The
banking industry.
Oh, the banking, yeah.
Those who can provide both for a return of my lending you money and what kind of collateral are you going to use for promise of more money? So the big green-eyed monster comes out because everybody's seeing the possibilities and nobody's thinking about the what-ifs. I'm sure there were some people doing so, but this is often, again, the story of, don't worry about it, I know what I'm doing, I got the plan, and then all of a sudden you're like, oops.
And I mean, with Spain, it was really obvious. I mean, it happened over decades, but they, I mean, they had a big chunk of the Western Hemisphere. They literally claimed and had a military presence, and it just ran out of steam eventually. And finally, by the early 1800s, there were, the freedom revolution was in the air after the American Revolution and the French Revolution. So the colonies, Spain's colonies in South America and Mexico's, prime example, they had revolutions, and they separated from Spain. So now Spain has gone from being this, global empire to, a chunk of land over there on the Iberian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And it didn't take that long, that transition. So Bob and I were talking about that, when we're talking about the rise and fall of empires. My class was the rise and fall of ancient empires, now that I remember it. So
right.
I didn't have to deal with the modern ones.
Gotcha.
We're talking about the modern ones today. But so that Bob and I are looking for those parallels where we are today and, whether it's the U.S. or other empires around the world, you can talk about, Russia, another prime example.
We've got economic and we've got military empires. Yeah. And the three principles are China, Russia, and the United States, with a lot of emerging kind of countries in between, but all competing in different ways for influence and wealth.
In a way, it's like with empire, it's like if you don't keep expanding, you're going to contract.
Mm-hmm.
There's no steady state when you have an empire, and it's because if you do assemble a big wealthy empire and the glorious capital at Rome or wherever, and the guys way up in Northern Europe who are don't have all that, they start thinking, wow, I want a piece of that. And the barbarian tribes, as they call them, come down and try to grab a piece for themselves.
Right. So we've got we're up against a break here.
We could take the break now. Okay. That's fine. And the phone lines are open, by the way. If you have a question or a comment for Peter Stark, adventure historian, Bob Seidenschwartz also joining us here in the studio with the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. We'll be right back, hopefully getting your phone calls after this. This is Talk Back. 721-1290 is our number. Hey, the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. Bob Seidenschwartz here with special guest Peter Stark, adventure historian. And we do have a caller, so let's get jump right in. We'll get our callers on as quickly as we can. Okay, Catherine, go ahead. You're on.
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering.
Hi, Catherine.
The Rothschilds family started the modern banking industry. The global banking industry, and what was it, 1744, I think, is when they get started. How does that intersect with the development and the ultimate, the rise of and fall of empires financially, because they financed so much of this stuff, and how much power did they acquire, and the global banking network acquire through the expansion of empires?
Oh, real great question. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm going to defer to Bob because he's the banker.
Okay. I've already been able.
I mean, I have a little idea. I don't really, that period of history is not one of my specialties, but yes, I mean, somebody had to bankroll these people.
Very quickly, Catherine, there's not a period of time historically where somebody wasn't behind the scenes providing capital.
I mean, going way back.
We're going way back to the present. So whether we say it's a Rothschild or the Bank of England or any number of entities, at some point, you're not self-funding. And we're no different right now in the United States. We got to borrow money. We go to our treasury. We borrow money. We have countries that invest in our currencies, as we've said many times on the show, U.S. Treasury. So nothing ever functions without the ability to have a system that provides that credit. And sometimes that credit gets to be very expensive for those that are borrowing. There's credit risk in terms of what's the probability of being paid back. So
Your ship sinks.
That's why you have insurance. So it's always a part and a critical part of the component of what makes all economies. And right now, I could probably make a pretty good case, but I won't because of the time. But the world's a bit overextended, not just the United States. When I look at the debt ratios across many different countries, we're in a position right now where disruption, if it lasts too long, can have very painful consequences.
Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, I was just thinking because, you know, the banks require collateral. There's always a need for collateral to finance anything. So anybody who wants to borrow money to expand or to explore or to create has to borrow money from banks, and then banks then own the collateral until it is paid off. And it seems to never get paid off. Is that right?
It probably doesn't get paid off because we're making decisions, because the bank also has very strict requirements. Yeah. And if we remember the financial crisis not too long ago, the banking system got rather loose with who they were lending money to, especially for mortgages. Yeah. So the banks, after that, tightened up their credit requirements so that you had to come back in with 20-30% down. So we go through these periods of boom and bust. And that's a point that we're really trying to make on the show, talking about this, is historically we've gone through this. So why would we think right now and into the future it's going to be different? Because we're always making decisions based on risk, greed, and opportunity.
Well, and reward.
And I mean, reward.
And as a calculation.
Right. Yeah.
Catherine, that was such a good question. In the case of the United States, I mean, you know, the modern United States, it borrows money from the American people or from whomever in the world wants to buy, like a U.S. Treasury bond.
Yeah, and because of our credit standing, because of our economic strength, because of our military strength, at the moment, we still stand tall when you look at the global markets. So we got to get to a caller here.
We have one more caller. This is Dave. Dave, go ahead. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, the U.S. has been the world's largest debtor nation since the 1980s, like $38 trillion. And we one of the reasons we are able to handle that deficit because other countries judge us as stable and secure. But when we tell Europe that we don't like them anymore and we'd like to get away from the helping them and Japan and China, I mean, we risk having them withhold money from to help run our government, our country. So, I mean, we have to be careful. We're not burning the bridges that are helping our economy to keep going.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be a real disaster.
Thanks, Dave.
If the world. Yeah, good, really good point. Really good point, Dave. That would be a disaster if the financial world globally lost faith in the dollar as a very safe store of value in U.S. investments. Right. That would be a horrific crash.
Now, being an author, is that something you've thought of, just looking at the sheer financial side of all these explorations and who was doing the funding and how they were profiting from that?
Well, to some degree in certain expeditions. I know that, for instance, it's kind of curious that, you know, Jamestown, which was really the first British colony in what's now the U.S. in 1607, but they were called a company of adventurers, and they were like high risk investors in this thing.
Wow.
And it was a commercial enterprise. And so these guys are always trying to raise money, every single one of them, all these expeditions.
Well,
and the king and queen sometimes funded them, but a lot of times it was like private investors saying, okay, I think I'm going to get a big payoff if I invest in this boat going to North America.
So here's a parallel to today. Jared Kushner is in the Middle East. He's been representing the United States in negotiations with Iran. He's also talking to many of the Emirates and various wealth accumulators over there about raising $5 billion for his private equity fund. At the same time, he's negotiating these agreements with Iran. So it never stops.
It never stops. The scramble for money is like,
I'll tell you what, I'll sell you a few weapons here, but I got this new fund I'm opening up. What do you think?
There have been a lot of deals like that over the course of history.
I promise you, folks. And actually, Peter and I, Corey
Lewandowski.
What can I tell you?
Yeah. Right. I got a deal for you.
Yeah, well, you know, remember the guy in Chicago with a B? He was like the governor. And he
went to jail for several years. Yeah,
because somebody died in the Illinois, you know, the U.S. senator from Illinois died, so there was a vacant seat which he could appoint anybody he wanted to. And he was recorded saying, oh, this is a golden opportunity. And it was like he's auctioning it off.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Let's get Skip on. Skip, good morning. You're on with Peter Stark and Bob Seidenschwartz. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
Hey.
And it's always exciting when Mr. Stark comes on, because we delve into stuff all over the globe that not a lot of people thought of, and it's always fun to visit.
Okay, so, great. Well, thanks for that, Skip.
Well, the thing is that you did, and I heard a sentence that spurred me to call, and the sentence had to do with the value of the dollar and how we were looked at globally and in your crystal ball, as time goes on, and Bob's there, who's a finance guy that's equally a guru about these kinds of things, are we in trouble in the future, or is it possible that we're in trouble with the value of the dollar because of what, like the BRIC nations and other conspiracies that I'll call them, are trying to devalue something that should be the most stable currency on Earth?
Well, Skip, I'd say, you know, the crystal ball, which I don't have.
Thanks, Skip.
Good point. My short answer would be yes. There's certainly that hazard. I mean, that risk. And, I mean, nobody can predict whether it's going to happen for sure, or it might happen somewhat, or it might not happen at all, that there's some faith lost in the solidity of U.S. finance instruments in the dollar. Is that right, Bob, when you say that?
We got to go to a break, and when we come back, I'll make a couple of quick comments.
Okay, we're going to come right back, and the time is slipping past. We only have about 8 minutes left in our time with Peter Stark, and so we're going to come back right after this one-minute timeout. Hey, it's Peter. Hey, we're back. This is Talk Back, and we only have about seven minutes left in our time together with Peter Stark. So let's redeem the time, gentlemen. Go ahead.
Okay, we're going to figure out how to strengthen the dollar in those 7 minutes, Bob. Yeah. No problem. But Bob's going to talk a little bit about that, the value of the currencies.
But Hadrian's Wall.
But before we get
who
that,
is this?
So
guy?
Hadrian's Wall is really cool. Okay. It's up in Scotland. It's like halfway up Scotland, way out there in the Scottish Moors Highlands. And it's this big stone wall that essentially stretches across Scotland in a kind of a narrow spot, meaning it's still, I don't know, it's like 50 miles or more long. It's a big, solid wall. So Hadrian was a Roman emperor, and he built that wall so the barbarian tribes couldn't climb over it and invade his colony of Britain.
Wow.
So think of that. I mean, from Rome all the way halfway up Scotland, that's how far the Roman Empire extended. Mm-hmm. Now, we talk about overextending.
Right.
And he's got this wall there, and he's got to man that wall with people all the time. Because those Scottish guys, you know how they throw logs and rocks and everything else?
The picks were nobody wanted to mess with, right?
Nobody wanted to mess with. Yeah. But so I'm just bringing that up. It's such a good image of, like, here is where the rising tide of the Roman Empire stopped, and the tide went back from there. And it went back very quickly. So by the mid-400s, they were about done. So go ahead, Bob.
And to Skip's question, a good analogy. Today we're on top, but we also have very little room for missteps. We said earlier in our conversation with Jeff, self-inflicted wounds are often the case where we could have made a decision, did not, would have paid a short-term pain and price for longer-term gain, as somebody had said earlier on the radio show. And we're very much in that situation right now. So competitively, the United States still has major advantages, but that doesn't mean it's forever.
Well, I think that's the key point. Nothing's forever.
Yeah.
And that I think that's something that's really easy to lose sight of. And I think that's been the case in every dominant empire that ever existed anywhere in the world, that we're so on top of things, we can do whatever we want.
Well,
and not a single one has survived. Not a single one.
No.
So it's like we shouldn't get, what I want to say, you know, there's the classic Roman term, Latin term, hubris, right?
Right.
Which means
arrogance.
Arrogance and pride. And that, you know, that's known as the great fall.
Pride kills.
Of leaders.
Right.
And I think it's really important that we, anyone, you know, as an individual or as a nation or as a, you know, empire, if you want to call it that, don't fall into that trap that of hubris, because it's a dead end for sure.
And at the moment, I know people are aligning on both sides that are going to say, you know, what is the purpose of this action right now with Iran? I don't think anybody that's ever called in or any conversations I've ever had that agree that Iran was a good place with the current leadership.
Yeah.
Nobody has said so.
But, and the other thing I wanted to point out about Iran, that we talked about this a bit, that Iran, you know, you just think it's some random country out there in the high desert. Or Iran is one of the oldest, has one of the oldest civilizations on the planet. The first Persian civilization was started in 2,500 years ago.
Our friend Mirdad Kia is a guest on the show quite a bit,
yeah.
And he is from Iran and is Persian. And and let me tell you, there's no better source to find out what's going on there than him.
So. I've heard him talk, and he's really fascinating on that subject. But I think that's part of our arrogance in going into a country that a lot of people think is just some random country, and you're going to knock off the leadership and the identity is gone. Well, there's this Persian identity that's been around for 2,500 years. Mm-hmm. And so people aren't just going to say, well, I'm not Persian anymore and I'm going to walk away, no matter what happens to the leadership. It's a very entrenched civilization, basically.
So in our 2 minutes that are remaining, we've talked about military adventurism, overextending, leverage the financial markets briefly from the standpoint that always somebody's got to be able to finance these adventures, and that can become a problem when the game goes the wrong way for you. The environmental issues, which were part of the world for thousands of years, which affected empires, and the same situation and result is in place today. And then technology disruption. So as people are listening to this, just kind of overlay that with what's happening in our world today. Outcomes, some are going to be very positive, and there's going to be many that are unexpected that will have consequences that we're going to go, oops.
And we got about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
If you'd share more about your new book.
Oh,
what you're working on.
Talk about overextending the empire.
There you go. Yeah.
I put a lot of my life into that book, and I hope it goes somewhere.
Well, tell us about it.
So, I've talked about it before, but it's about Coronado, this, you know, Spanish conquistador, like Cortez, who conquered the Aztecs, or Pizarro, who conquered the Incas. And Coronado came along a few years after those guys, and they'd scored big time with a lot of gold and empires. And Coronado headed north thinking he's going to find golden empires up there. Well, the funny thing is, he gets up there, and the tribes are very clever. They say, oh, that's what you're looking for. You know, he holds up this piece of gold. And, oh, that's what you're looking for. Oh, we don't have any here, but you just keep going that way and you'll get there. And so I'm really compressing it. But another really interesting point about this is that the tribes, Coronado kept looking for the palace on the hill and the king. And, you know, he was gonna decapitate it. There was no palace on the hill.
Right.
All these tribes were interwoven.
Peter Stark, it's always delightful having you on. You're a fascinating guy. And best of luck on your book.
Okay, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Bob.
You're welcome.
All right, as we go ahead. Nick, please, go ahead.
Yeah, we're going to have best ofs on tomorrow and Friday, because I will be out. But We will be back on Monday with State Auditor Insurance Commissioner James Brown.
Awesome. All right. Get out there and have a great day, everybody. And again, thanks. Thanks to Peter. Thanks to Bob and all of you for your phone calls. Have yourselves a great day, and it'll be best of the next couple of days.